Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and it's been quite the week for me. So I don't know exactly how coherent I'm going to be in this episode today, but I'm sure we can still say some interesting and worthwhile things. I'm joined today by just Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you? And thank you very much for being on the show today by your lonesome.
Nick, and hi everyone. Doing well, thank you. Very always very glad to be on the show with you. Hopefully I will be enough. It will just be the two of us. So I'm sure we'll manage our way through this, but yeah, quite a bit for us to get through here at the end of another warm week in Johannesburg. At least it's been a bit cooler the last day or two. We'll see if that helps in terms of some of the water challenges. But I think at this point, if that's one's last best hope is that the weather is 2 or 3 degrees a bit cooler. Things are already quite a way gone from you.
Yeah, no, it's very much like the height of load shedding when you knew the day was a little bit colder than you expected. You were going to have lots of outages. It's not a good place to be in.
No.
But anyway, we're not actually going to talk about water today. We had a lot of discussions about that over the recent days. Let's get into our first topic today, and this is the sort of third group that's going to be taking on the National Health Insurance in the courts has launched their court papers, have sent out their court papers. This is the South African Private Practitioners Forum. They say in their court papers that President Ramaphosa failed to discharge constitutional duties when signing the National Health Insurance Act into law. This group is the largest association of medical specialists, and they've now started their legal action against the Department of Health and the presidency. This is joining legal attacks by, I think, Solidarity, and I can't actually remember the other group. I would slip my mind at the minute, at the moment. But anyway, I'll come back to that. But this is the third such major legal attack, basically on NHI, to have it declared unlawful. Now, just a reminder for those who are not aware, NHI is essentially the idea that all government spending, or at least the vast, vast majority of government spending, of healthcare spending, should flow through government. So currently we have a private sector which is paid for by individuals, and then we have a government sector which is paid for also by individuals, but is channeled through government through tax money. Well, NHI says all the money you're paying into your medical insurance now will go into a government medical insurance thing called the National Health Insurance, and they will decide how that money is spent. If you've paid any attention over the last 30 years of South African governance, you will agree perhaps that the potential for that money being, shall we say, badly spent, misspent, or stolen is not zero. So, Chris, I think this is one of those key things about the sort of future of the country if the government of national unity is going to succeed. I know that the DA and I think the Freedom Front Plus have basically opposed NHI, and they've sort of suggested that they might leave the government of national unity if the ANC goes ahead with it. It's they haven't been, like, I think, definitive, because I think they want to keep their options open. But in my opinion, the National Health Insurance is the most surefire way to ruin South Africa's chances of economic growth. Why do I say that? Because firstly, I don't think it's going to do a lot for the poor, because as I alluded to, I think a lot of the money that government sends through the NHI is going to be misspent, which won't actually improve healthcare in outcomes for the poor. But more than that, it will damage the healthcare of the middle class. And that means that those people will begin looking at alternative places to live than South Africa. You can get by with a lot of things, but if you're literally not allowed to have the kind of healthcare that you might want, or if it's so expensive that middle class people basically can't afford it anymore, there's another possibility of what NHI will do. You're going to have skilled professionals leaving, and you're going to have lower income people sort of finding ways to skirt the system, maybe. And this would be in many ways a death sentence, I think, for our economy, which is already a very fragile state. Chris, your thoughts on this issue, and do you think these court challenges might succeed?
So going through it firstly from the sort of risk point of view, I mean, at the moment, Transnet and its ongoing inability to move as much tonnage volumes as it should be doing, given its complex and developed infrastructure. Given that Eskom seems to have somewhat of its house in order, the lights stay on, Transnet is now the current binding constraint on substantive economic activity in things like heavy industry, construction, manufacturing, getting our exports out there, so earning from the commodities mining. Yeah, exactly. Going forward then, I think the NHI stands out as arguably the risk that could mean the GNU falls apart, number one, and number two, that the pro-growth reforms that are to some element being implemented, and those aren't deep enough, things around visa reforms, etc. You need more substantive labor policy reforms and those sorts of things. And the NHI risks undermining and undercutting positive work that is being done. When you've had positive sentiment attained through the formation of the GNU, the Rand appreciating markedly, especially against other emerging currencies, but also even against the US dollar. When you've got more global interest in South African assets and South African government bonds, more interest in a positive sense in terms of investing in South Africa, when you introduce something like the NHI, you just undermine all that good work that you did, for example, in the last 100 days. Now, how you implement it, there will be questions around, do you do it in a sort of overnight shotgun approach manner? Do you do it in a more systematic way? I think the important thing to keep in mind is it's an irresponsible and bad policy in and of itself, no matter how it's implemented. So, you know, there's always some of the defenders will say it won't be implemented in a haphazard way. It'll be done responsibly. In its very nature, in its wording, it is destructive. So even assuming the most benevolent, well-intentioned bureaucrats and politicians, it is set up to destroy private healthcare, to not fix the issues in public care, and also to just pool more resources that inevitably will lead to waste and corruption. That's not to say it's on any one particular political party, but any minister or party that is afforded the powers to appoint the members of the NHI fund board, who has that right, ability to allocate funds, to reprioritize spending from the provinces to national. The incentives there for corruption just, they're built in. It's a feature, not a bug. So all of that taken in mind, it poses serious risks to the GNU and the economy, which means those parties that have said, for example, they'll walk away if the ANC specifically pursues policies that pose an existential risk to the economy and the constitution, they should then very much hold to that line.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, having such a huge pot of money sort of so centrally directed, yes, you could say, oh, well, there's a board, or there'll be safeguards, or there'll be parliamentary oversight. But we've seen how this stuff has gone in other state-owned enterprises. As our colleague Terence Corrigan often points out, there's going to be a state-owned enterprise whose entire purpose will be the collection and spending of money. Essentially, the politician who controls this will be the king of patronage in the country. Your ability to basically direct flows in improper ways, I think, will be very real. And that's why it's just so dangerous. Is you know, the moment you start messing with people's healthcare, no one in the country, and especially no one who's worked very hard to make sure that they can afford a medical health insurance, which, you know, contrary to some of the complaints of people like the health minister, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, he claims, you know, that attacks in the NHI are some kind of racially motivated thing by white South Africans or to keep black people out of their healthcare system or some nonsense like that. It's of course worth reminding the health minister, I'm paraphrasing, that isn't directly what he said, but it's worth reminding the health minister that more than half of private medical aid holders are actually black South Africans. Mm-hmm. This is very much a cross-racial, across the middle class problem. And these are the people in your society who are the key to starting new businesses, to providing the skills for everything from business to government. And, you know, none of them want to sit there in a hospital where the resources aren't being spent correctly, dying because they can't get the test they want. They can't get the treatment they want. They have to wait on a list for an operation that they need. These are all the things that I think are almost inevitable if NHI is implemented. And nothing like the prospect of bad healthcare. I mean, you know, I know two people who basically were left to die in public hospitals. You know, there's some very good healthcare people in public hospitals, but the management and the resources are just not there to make them work properly. Mm-hmm. If that kind of spending, you know, those sort of spending habits are followed through in the private sector, that is something that is going to terrify the middle class in a very serious way. So as far as I'm concerned, one of the key objectives of measuring the success of the Government of National Unity is whether NHI is either blocked in some sort of way, it's not like actually implemented, or alternatively, it's repealed, or it is so substantially reformed that it no longer poses the current danger that it does to our economy and our society. Chris, any final thoughts on this one?
Just on the court cases and whether some of these or all will succeed or not, I guess a lot hinges on, of course, the focus thereof around constitutional violations in the NHI legislation, but also around things like the certificate of need, doctors, nurses, health professionals, their freedom to work where they choose to and whether parts of the NHI undermine that. So that sort of idea of individual freedom to work, I think should be in where possible in these cases be a strong focus. I think also hopefully it's a better approach that there are more cases versus just one or two consolidated cases by many organizations where, yes, you could maybe pool or share resources, but you should, I think, try and attack the parts, the pillars of the NHI, as many of those as possible.
No, definitely. And I do think there are constitutional problems with this bill. Not that I am a legal expert. And I hope that the courts agree with me. Okay, let's move on to our next story. President Ramaphosa has made a commitment that he is going to, that him and his government is going to support the motor industry in South Africa. South Africa actually makes quite a few cars, which are then usually exported, I believe, to the European market. We do make some sort of luxury brands here, but as one would imagine, this is also one of those manufacturing sectors that struggled quite a bit. Motor industry has contributed 5.3% to GDP and is about 15% of South Africa's exports in 2023. So it's a pretty big deal, but it's been suffering recently, and a lot of those problems are to do with the same things that hurt many manufacturing jobs in the country. One, the labor laws are very strict, so it is very difficult to fire non-performing workers. Two, the minimum wage is quite high, which means that on the sort of outer bands of productivity, it's not really worth hiring new workers. It's better rather to automate, which is often quite expensive. And so you either think to yourself, maybe we should build the car somewhere else, or you say, rather than hiring people, we're going to invest in you know, some sort of robot that can do more of the work itself. And the other reason is that unions have had a very antagonistic relationship with the motor industry. Lots of big strikes that have often gotten quite nasty over the years. So, Chris, you know, what does it mean for the president to say he is committing to supporting the motor industry? Does this mean he's going to change policy? I mean, what are the indications here?
Yeah, so I don't think there'll be any substantial or clear departure from things like the localization master plans, away from more subsidies for companies in the automotive sector. And also, there won't be a departure away from potentially higher tariffs on imports, whether it's components or vehicles, anything like that. This is all in the context globally where the uptake of an adoption by consumers of pure electric vehicles, so not hybrids and plug-in hybrids, but the adoption of pure EVs has steadily declined this year. So is it, if you're going to support the sort of adoption by consumers of EVs and you want to encourage your manufacturers in your country to manufacture those, and you give subsidies where your fiscus is already very constrained, but there's no consumer demand for it. I mean, talk about what jumps to mind is some of those larger cities in China or in the Middle East that have been built by those governments, but there's no, people don't live in those areas. So it becomes the sort of
right, brand, yeah.
vanity project, but nothing of substantive worth.
No, exactly. We had, you know, while Ibrahim Patel was running the Department of Trade and Industry, we'd have all these grand strategic plans. No, we're going to boost this particular manufacturing industry to be this and this and this. And this just seems a little bit more of the same kind of thing. It's like, ah, yes, we've identified motor manufacturing as a strategic industry and we're going to boost it. And you've tried this. It hasn't worked.
We mentioned this before we started recording, is if you as government decide that all sectors are strategic, then by definition, none are strategic. And again, you as a bureaucrat or a politician, yes, you might be one of the most well-read, well-experienced people, let's say in automotive. That was maybe where you first worked before you moved into politics. So you think you understand it very well, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, you don't know how consumers are going to behave necessarily. There will be shifts, there will be changes. And now that you've identified the sector and you're giving subsidies, thereby propping up some companies that should be exposed to market forces. Some will succeed, some will fail, unfortunately. And overall, South Africa's automotive industry will become more competitive and well-developed. You're propping up those who don't deserve to be propped up necessarily because, again, there's so much political, so much of your political weight, you've hedged on one or two of those succeeding. So this isn't to discount the jobs that have been created in that sector, in that industry, but I don't think in the global context, when you talk about some of the issues at the forefront at the moment, that this is one of those strategic, quote unquote, strategic sectors. And then just the sort of last major point is, if you don't fix some of the basic enablers of manufacturing heavy industry activity, so things like reliable, cheap electricity, a logistics network that functions, your railways, your ports, your bureaucratic labor side of things, so flexible labor laws, easier for people to appoint and also to let go of employees, encouraging that upskilling and that movement of people into jobs. If you don't fix those very difficult but necessary things, you can pump in all the subsidies, all the other forms of support to certain select companies, and they won't over time be truly globally competitive. Because what you're giving them in terms of subsidies and higher tariffs on imports, they have to use and pay into making up for the services that the state isn't providing. So it's already wasted subsidies and wasted spending, I guess.
No, that's exactly right. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is about some violence that recently broke out in Sharpeville. Hundreds of Sharpeville residents on Thursday looted shops belonging to foreign nationals. And this was allegedly in response to the murder of a local South African shop owner who was killed allegedly by foreign nationals. And this whole story has a sort of mafia-esque vibe to it. A person identified, and I'm always kind of amused by these identifications in the media because I sort of think to myself, like, how does one get appointed a community leader? Anyway, a quote-unquote community leader, Jacob Mataletsa, said the community was angry about the growing number of foreign-owned shops. Their anger was fueled, he said, by the murder of the popular South African shop owner, Papi Mokema, who lived in the area on Wednesday. He claims that this murder was carried out by foreign nationals who own spaza shops. He said, quote, since 2013, we have been engaging with foreign nationals about escalating number of shops in Sharpeville. On Saturday, we met with foreigners. We ordered them to close their shops. We have 236 shops owned by foreign nationals, while only a few are owned by locals. We then decided to close their shops today. We don't condone the looting of shops. We are shocked to see pupils in school uniform joining us and looting shops, he said. And then he pointed out to the journalist who was interviewing him that looting is, in fact, a crime. Well, I would venture that when you open the door to burning people's shops and without any legal authority threatening them, that you can't necessarily control whether those shops are going to be looted. One woman who was interviewed by News 24, a woman called Shidi Majoya, said that her only source of income was the shop she was renting out in her backyard. She's a South African. She was renting out the shop in her backyard to a Pakistani national who was paying her 2,000 rand a month for the rent. She said that this was her only income that she was using to feed her children. She went on to say, quote, they claim they don't want foreigners in our area, yet they steal their food. What has happened? There's nothing I can do, but they have taken away my livelihood. The shop owner was cooperative and has never given me a single problem. With his rental money, I was able to feed my two children, to pay for my funeral, and to pay for my funeral policies. Today, Sharpeville residents don't want all foreigners in the area. They claim they don't want foreigners in our area, yet they steal their food. What happened in my yard is looting. I asked the looters if they were going to give me my rental money. They didn't respond. I'm speechless. This is wrong. They should have done this thing in a civilized manner. I am willing to take my tenant back. And this is, I think, you know, it's an amazing example of kind of how government failure has just sort of forced this kind of mafiaization of so much of the country. I mean, who knows what exactly happened here? Maybe the original shop owner was killed by a foreign national, and maybe that had something to do with their business and that this was sort of unfair business practice. But then the response is not, you know, we're going to have a police investigation. The police are going to sort through the issue, investigate the crime, find the people responsible, bring them to book. We're not going to have, you know, sort of zoning and regulation people to make sure that no one is cheating when it comes to like the shops and taxes and all these sort of things. No. The response is we've got to take matters into our own hand and burn the people out. Who knows? Maybe this is all just an excuse and this is simply a way of South African shop owners trying to drive out competition for their businesses. You know, it's very difficult to tell with these things ahead of time what's actually going on under the surface. But the reality is that people suffer. One of the reasons that foreign-owned shops often do well is because the shop owners often are they come from really, really harsh countries, and so they're often willing to live very frugally, which means they can keep their prices lower. Especially the Pakistani and Somali shopkeepers are Muslim, so they usually don't drink, which means they have more money to kind of spend on their business. There's also the fact that because they're Muslims, they usually don't believe in credit, because usury for pious Muslims is a sin, which means that they either offer interest-free loans or very low interest loans to their customers, which when you're very poor is very important for buying something like food. So firstly, people in those areas are going to suffer because they're going to lose access to some of these shops. And secondly, people are going to suffer because they're losing things like rent and that kind of stuff. Never mind the general bad example this is setting for people, like when you have school kids joining in on the looting of a shop. It's not really good for the fabric of society, I don't think. Chris, you know, it's clear to me that the police should be all over this thing, but it's kind of wild that, you know, there's just some sort of mention that the police got to the area kind of long after the fact to try and control the riot, but doesn't seem to have actually stopped the thing. The police say, we are monitoring the situation. Well, doesn't seem to have done much. The only people they've arrested are a couple of foreign nationals who apparently had unlicensed firearms. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, the police sort of making a show of things after the fact reminds one of the former minister of police who had an uncanny knack of arriving at crime scenes and other places of serious crime long afterwards and making a big show of it and then nothing of substance actually happening. So two things I think to consider here. Number one is when you've got such perennially high unemployment, unemployment rates, you know, 37%, if not higher on the official definition, and on the expanded definition, 47%, if not higher, that sort of environment where people feel their own prospects for themselves or their families, their communities has materially worsened over the last 10 to 15 years, that sort of acceleration, service delivery, quality thereof has declined, even in the biggest metros, those that should have the biggest budgets and the most spending on infrastructure, on service delivery, access to quality, to water, schools, housing, all that sort of stuff. Take that then in combination with a government on the policing side that doesn't take that proactive, on the ball focused approach and only rocks up, you know, a little bit afterwards. And what is going to fill the void? Something, you know, some element of organization or taking ownership and responsibility of the situation is going to manifest. And sometimes it will be in very destructive ways for everyone involved, both for South Africans, also for foreign shop owners, foreign employees, workers, et cetera, et cetera. There's been so much in terms of studies all around the world as to the benefits afforded by immigrants in terms of economic benefits, in terms of paying taxes, creating jobs. The data and the numbers are there on that side, but it doesn't account for the sort of emotive thing around when you maybe feel that your quote unquote job has been taken by someone else, a more emotive way of dealing with the situation is going to appeal to you. And I think we shouldn't be surprised when that happens. Indeed, it's almost a surprise that it isn't a more regular occurrence, especially in a province like Gauteng. I mean, the population of which has grown by around 80% since 2004. That's a massive growth within the country, but also from foreigners in terms of pressures on services, pressures on local businesses, in terms of employment, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I think all in all, the situation persists and requires serious substantive work by especially national government, but also in the context of the 2026 local government elections, provincial and local governments to get a handle on those issues facing the various communities that which they are supposed to serve.
Right. You know, there is, as you said, that, you know, an issue like this is just so complicated. It ties back into everything from people not trusting the police to just kind of generally bad policing to the economic conditions in the country, which are so bad. And, you know, when the stakes are so high, people will spill blood for to make sure that their business works or that they can maybe get in on looting a shop or something like that. And, you know, these are the kind of incidents, I think, that really have the potential to create warlordism and really destroy the country in a lot of ways. I think when you have basically the total breakdown of law and order, and we saw that, I think, in the July 2021 riots, which thankfully, you know, kind of stopped and ran out of steam. And I think, you know, there's less appetite for that kind of thing to happen again, partly because I think it was sort of almost like a madness that people woke up from the next day and said, whoops, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. But still, you know, when you have these bad economic conditions, the lack of law and order, this is the inevitable result. And people will turn on each other. And this is, this is obviously not good for furthering our future prospects. This is not going to help improve anyone's lives really particularly much. Not the South Africans, not the foreigners. Any final thoughts?
I think the realization on the part of the government here, but also maybe the realization that needs to happen on the part of South Africans, civil society, think tanks, local governments, councillors, that the GNU might make some positive strides in some things, but if we keep on adding priorities to its list in and of itself, also again, nothing is a priority. So to wait for that sort of positive change to come from there on a deep and meaningful level might be, by then, in all likelihood, be too late. So there's an opportunity, but also a very big risk that, again, we fall for the idea of just wait for the GNU to fix it.
Yeah, Chris, our priorities are education, healthcare, economic growth, policing, security, and environmental protection. it's not really a priority. Okay, let's move on to our last story. Not huge amount to say about this. Apparently, so let me just give a little bit of background on this one. Anyone who's followed the discussions between the conflict between China and Taiwan knows that the People's Republic of China, what we normally refer to as China, insists that you cannot recognize both it and Taiwan as countries at the same time because they claim that Taiwan is part of China. And so most countries in the world adhere to what is called the One China policy, where they agree that there is one China. Now, Taiwan itself also agrees with this. It's just that they argue that they are China. The official name of Taiwan is the Republic of China, as opposed to the People's Republic of China. Anyway, South Africa recognized Taiwan as the One China up until 1998. But one of the... since we've changed, we've continued to have trade and diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and many countries in the world do this. Rather than recognizing Taiwan as an independent country, there's always just a slight change in language. You don't have an embassy with Taiwan, you have a Taipei liaison office. Now, apparently, the Chinese government has been putting pressure on South Africa, this is according to the Daily Maverick, to force the Taipei liaison office, which is currently in Pretoria, out of the capital. Because the Chinese do not want anyone to be under any illusions that this is in some way maybe an embassy even though it de facto is, regardless of what they call it. This has really annoyed Taiwan, who are not nearly as big of a trade partner as South Africa as they used to be back in the sort of like 80s and 90s, but they're still relatively important. Sources in the Taiwanese foreign ministry are thinking of retaliating against South Africa if South Africa kicks the liaison office out of Pretoria and forces it to move to Johannesburg, restricting things like, you know, educational exchanges and making it harder for South Africans to get visas and things like that to go to Taiwan. And, you know, my take on this, Chris, is that we already recognize big China, communist China, as the China, right? As the China. We have trade relations with them. We're part of BRICS with them. We're always saying nice things about them in public. President Ramaphosa in particular seems to be very friendly towards China. I don't really see how doing something so sort of petty and symbolic is really going to do much to change our relationship with China. I doubt if we didn't move the embassy that the Chinese would really care that much. Even if they prefer it, they'd probably be like, okay, well, it's not like we're going to cut trade with South Africa. And yet the potential here is just kind of to irritate Taiwan and irritate Taiwan's allies, who include other big trading partners of ours, like the United States. What's your take on this, Chris?
Yeah, I think there's such a strong, a big opportunity for the government of national unity to adopt a different geopolitical stance and also implement foreign policy differently from the administrations that came before in a way that puts the country's interests first, and also attains all possible avenues for investment and trade flows to increase. And part of that is then for a country like China that is in some ways putting pressure on the South African government in this regard, to push back against that, and for China also to realize just how crucial South Africa is to China and China's economic future, China's influence in Africa and the sub-Saharan African subcontinent. I think there needs to be that sense on the part of the South African government around an element of self-worth, and what you, when you speak to certain values, as you do ostensibly around the conflict between Israel and Hamas, when you don't then pursue those values in every opportunity, by virtue of that, you're not seen to be actually holding to those things. And that in turn even undercuts you with those countries like China, where the Chinese government does prefer to trade with countries and governments that are relatively more stable and predictable, where things aren't constantly flip-flopping and changing overnight. So it stands to your benefit, I think, in a world where geopolitics is becoming all the more influential in trade and investment flows, when there's more geopolitical distance between countries, not, of course, only between the US and China, but between countries in the developing bracket, as it were. If you're one of those countries that sets your stall in terms of you practice what you preach, even for those who disagree with you, they'll be more open to trading with you and for those bilateral trade agreements, those investment flows, et cetera, et cetera. So I know it's a difficult pill to swallow, especially for the South African government, but if you want to be a bit more pragmatic, you actually then need to be pragmatic.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, right, and I'm speaking entirely in my personal capacity here, morally speaking, we should recognize Taiwan over the People's Republic of China. But practically speaking, you know, there's so many drawbacks to that. China is a huge, important trading partner. China is a major consumer of stuff like our minerals that we want to sell, you know, stuff like that. That's just, you know, you can't actually, if you're a responsible statesman, you can't do that because you'd be jeopardizing the, at least in the short term, for sure, the economic future of millions of South Africans. So practically, we do have to have good relations with China. But South Africa's policy should be one of neutrality. Neutrality means you don't take a side. Yes, we have already had to say that, okay, the PRC is the real China, and that's fine, and we have trade relations with them. And, you know, there's lots of things we can do to make them happy with us. But kind of just putting your thumb in the eye of Taiwan, no real good reason, and other than it might give you a few little brownie points with the Chinese government, probably not that many, because you're already so on side. That's not neutrality. That's not smart politics, I don't think. And that's really just causing problems for no real reason other than you want to prove some sort of symbolic point. And of course, Taiwan is feeling very besieged right now because the People's Republic of China has been very successful in isolating them, at least officially, diplomatically, even though so many countries around the world continue to have these de facto diplomatic relations with them, even though they're not recognized as an independent country, that they're likely to retaliate. And this is just going to make some South Africans who have links to Taiwan's lives more difficult for nothing. Anyway, I don't think we're really risking much by allowing the quote-unquote liaison office to stay in Pretoria. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts, Chris, before we close for today?
Just that here an opportunity again for parties other than the ANC and the GNU to strike a different line or a different message. Obviously, it depends how they would do that, what they use their platform for. But there is here, I think, again, an opportunity to introduce different ways of thinking about the country's foreign policy and to shift it away from where it has been. It's a question of tactics, obviously, communication, strategy. What platforms do you use? Do you do it very publicly? Do you do it behind the scenes? Where can you shift people the most? But it does open up something there for other parties to really set themselves up while they're still part of the GNU, to indicate to voters where they see things differently and why voters should value that and agree with them.
Right. You don't have to vote with the Americans or whatever in the UN, but you also probably don't have to have military exercises with Iran, China, and Russia. you can avoid both of those and save yourself some headaches. Anyway, bye, everyone. Hope you all found the show interesting. We will be back next weekend. Next week. You can see my mind is all over the place today. I hope you found the show worthwhile nonetheless. And I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone. Have a great one.